Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Hometown Alaska. My name is Charles Woolforth, and our topic today, in one way, is Back to the Future. We're talking about the Susitna Hydro Project, which was one of the biggest political issues of, I guess I would say, my youth, the 70s and 80s, was canceled and now is back under consideration in the legislature this year. But it's Back to the Future in a different way because the issues we're talking about today are different. Back in the 70s and 80s, there wasn't much discussion about carbon mitigation or reducing fossil fuel use. The discussion then was very different. And now there's new reasons to build a large hydro project. On the other hand, there's always environmental impacts to any hydro project that's built. So we're going to explore all of those issues and hopefully educate you about the Susitna project, why we'd want to build it, or maybe why we wouldn't, and have a good roundtable discussion here in the studio, and also get your calls. I know there are a lot of strong feelings about this project. In fact, I even had a phone call on my home recorder when I came back from vacation from someone who said, well, I heard you're talking about this. I can't call in, but here's what I want to say. So this is your chance to speak out and talk to our experts. And as soon as I introduce them, I'm going to give you the phone number. So get your pencil ready. We've got three gentlemen here to talk about the project today. Brian Carey is a senior project manager with the Alaska Energy Authority, and he's an expert on this project and has been working on it for some time and a longtime Alaskan. Welcome, Brian.
Thank you.
Toby Smith is the executive director of the Alaska Center for the Environment, a group that also for many years has had concerns about the project and I think knows a lot about it. And I'm glad to have you here, Toby.
Thanks, Chris.
And then on the phone is Chris. Chris Rose is the director of the Renewable Energy Alaska Project, or REAP, which is a organization which includes environmental members and power company members that supports moving to renewable energy and the study and development of renewable projects. And he's in New York City and was kind enough to join us by phone. Welcome, Chris.
Thanks, Charles. Good afternoon.
Great. It's great to have you here. So your participation is essential. The phone number here to get on with our experts and discuss the Susitna project is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. If you're outside of Anchorage, you can call toll-free at 888-353-5752. And we also take emails, and here's the email address you should make sure to use. It's hometownalaska@kska.org, hometownalaska@kska.org. That's the only email address that I will be monitoring during the show. So to kick off the discussion, I'd like to talk to, turn to Brian Carey to talk about what the project is, and briefly, where it is located. I know we're talking about a version which is smaller than the version that was talked about in the 80s, and that you've looked at various projects, and we have the whole hour, so we don't have to get all of that right now. But for those who hear Susitna and don't know what we're talking about, where would this Lewontana Dam be, and how much power would it actually produce?
Okay. The 1980s project was two different dams, one at Devil Canyon Dam, which is, one at Devil Canyon, and then one at Watonna. Watonna is 90 miles upstream on the Susitna River from Talkeetna, and Devil Canyon is probably, the dam location is probably more about 50 to 60 miles above Talkeetna. At that time, both the dams are going to be large. Watonna is going to be 885 feet, and the Devil Canyon Dam around 650 feet. What we are looking at right now is just to build Watonna Dam. That dam would be 700 foot high, and the 700 foot goes down to bedrock, so what would be seen above the water level is approximately 550 feet. So that is the only proposed dam at this point.
I see. And the price tag that's been put on that is roughly $5 billion. Is that right?
We've had estimates that go anywhere from 3.9 to 4.9 as what the dam cost and the access roads would be.
And in perspective, the project that was discussed back in the 80s, we were just discussing before we came on, that was roughly $5.4 billion, which now would be in the $11 billion range by inflationary measure. Let me turn to Chris Rose. Chris, we have a goal to increase our renewable energy in Alaska to 50%. We obviously get a large amount of our energy from natural gas for our electrical generation. Does that mean that this is a that this project is a slam dunk or something that we really need to be doing, or are there other considerations that you would put on it?
Well, it is true that last spring the legislature passed a bill that creates a 50% renewable electricity goal for the state. Now, to put that in perspective, the state of Alaska is already 24% renewable electricity because there's a lot of hydro, particularly in southeast, that already exists. So what we need to do is bump that up from 24 to 50%. And, of course, the reason to do that, there's actually a number of reasons to do that. One of the main reasons is that you're protected from the inflationary costs of fossil fuels. There's also mitigating carbon and a host of other advantages of renewable energy. And the thing about renewable energy, of course, though, is that it's always a little bit more up front, and then you have no fuel costs over the life of the project. And so I think one of the reasons this particular project is being considered is to help us reach that goal. I don't think it's the only way we could reach that goal, but it certainly would get us there if the project were built.
All right. Now I'd like to, in introducing our three guests, now talk to Toby Smith, who is the executive director of the Center for the Environment. The original project, way back when, had a lot of concerns about it. What are some of the concerns that you might have in looking at this low Wantana project? Fish, habitat, what are sort of the main areas you're concerned about?
Yeah, and thank you again for having me here. Well, actually, I think all of us in the room have the same goals. What Chris was just talking about, very important. We support the 50% goal for a lot of reasons. This particular project does have some merits in some ways. As Chris says, it could get us there very quickly. There are environmental concerns, to be honest, and we'll get into this more later, I'm sure, but some of our greater concerns are more actually economic. But on the environmental side, certainly there are fish that use the Susitna River as a corridor to get to clear water spawning streams. Certainly you're talking about a 39-mile-long dam in a wilderness area. So there's some considerations there that need to be addressed.
So when you say 30, it would back the water up for 39 miles?
That's my understanding, about 2 miles wide and about 39 miles long in terms with the current footprint.
So fish would probably be your primary concern?
That's certainly a concern, yeah. But again, I think I would just point out that one of our greater concerns is just the question of whether it's wise to put all of our energy eggs into one mega hydro and energy basket, per se, because we're talking about a lack of diversification. And so it's just something I think that is a big question that we have.
Yeah, so we'll get into that a little bit more later. I now want to invite a caller on the air who is my own father. And a little bit of a setup. He was telling me that he worked on this project as a attorney who specializes in government finance. And I thought maybe he could give us some perspective on why the project died the first time. So I'd like to welcome Eric Wolforth to the air.
Well, thank you, Charles. Right, and I was there in 1984 and 1985 attending meetings of what was then called the Alaska Power Authority, now the Energy Authority. And the FERC license, which was applied for in 1984, was the application for that was withdrawn 1 year later. Approximately, and this is in some of the reports that members of your group have seen, approximately $134 million was spent studying the large Susitna project, or $145 million, it's not entirely sure, and that's probably exclusive of the attorney's fees that were spent in attempting to get the FERC license. I remember it especially because it's the only time in my experience that an investment banker, a part of an investment banking team that was chosen to be the financiers of the project, actually stood up in a public meeting and said that the project was not financeable given its cost at that time. And that was at that time, I remember the FERC license was under application with a team of attorneys in Washington, D.C., and that FERC license, of course, it must have taken a month for those attorneys just to wind down their work. So a lot of money was spent back in the 80s, and we have right now a much smaller and probably more feasible project. But the little bit of reading I've done on it this morning gives me some pause as to financeability. The report that's before the board talks about a bond issue ultimately of 100% financing at a 5% interest cost bond issue for 50 years, which is a long bond issue, probably longer than I've ever seen in modern times. There's an 8-year time frame estimated from now until FERC licensing, and a very substantial state expenditure necessary to get to that point. The financing probably could not take place until that 8-year period was over. So those are some of the questions I would have as you look at what in many ways looks like a very attractive project for its clean, renewable energy.
Well, excellent points. Let me turn to Brian Carey, the project manager for the Energy Authority, about the financing. How much money is the legislature being asked for, or what is the for this total figure that we don't know exactly what it is? Maximum $4.9 billion. Where does the money come from?
Well, first off, in terms of the financing, to be 100% privately equity financed by without state participation, it's unlikely it'd ever move forward. As in regards to the rest of the financing, we're still in a conceptual stage at this point. We are still providing information for legislators, and they are going to be the ones that will make the decisions in terms of if there's participation, or if there's participation, what percent participation of the state there will be. And so for it to move forward, I guess I can mainly say is that it would have to be a state project, and there would be state participation, but what amount is, I don't know.
I see. And the mention was made of the study that was done from the previous project, and I just threw that in an inflation calculator. $135 million, 1985 would be $265 million now. Amazing that they spent $250 million studying the project and then canceled it. Is that information still usable, or does it kind of have to be redone for the different design?
Some of it's reusable, some not. We have a library of documents from the 1980s. It contains more than 3,500 documents concerning both the fish and wildlife and hydrology, climate, everything else. We are currently doing gap analysis, going through those documents for both fish, wildlife, determining what information can be used and what information needs to be researched again. And then once it's done, we will work with the regulatory agencies resource agencies to determine what the study plans would be, what needs to be studied out there in regards to fish and wildlife.
I see. Thank you, Eric Walforth, for being with us.
Thank you, Charles.
Now I'd like to talk to Thomas, who had a comment for us, calling from Anchorage. Thomas?
I just think that it's long overdue. It's a good investment, and that it would help fund the state spending. I think that rather than borrow a lot of money, we've got cash, and just pay for it. And I figure electricity would cost about 7 cents a kilowatt, and our energy prices could go down and help subsidize the bush. And, it's an investment in the future. Back in '84, everyone was saying, you know, give me my permanent fund so I can go back to Louisiana, my portion of it. And natural gas is cheap. And I think that it's the solution for our grandchildren, and we need jobs right now, and so people are willing to work for less, and I think now's a good time to do it.
Thanks for the comment. Has there been an estimate, since we don't know the total cost, has there been an estimate of what the cost would be per kilowatt hour, Brian?
The estimate in regards to the per kilowatt hour varies quite a bit in terms of what the state participation is. And so if the state was to do perhaps 50% depending on what the interest rates and stuff are, the rate that would be the wholesale price to the utilities would be competitive to what it is currently right now with gas. And so one of the big problems is if somebody says, I want to build a house 5 years from now, then the question would be is, what is the interest rates going to be on that house? What is the construction materials are going to be? We are still working to better look at those numbers. Mm-hmm. But if there is a 50%, then I'm going to just say guesstimate it somewhere in the wholesale is 5 to 7 cents a kilowatt.
I see. And then the 50%, I mean, it's not free money. We could spend that state money on something else if we chose to. So it's all, I mean, we can't, it sounds like the project is probably not feasible if it's 100% privately financed. And as you increase the public finance, then the kilowatt hour price and the feasibility goes up, but then there's something else you're not spending money on. Is that a fair way to look at it?
Yes, but I will mention, too, that that would not necessarily be grant money, depending on how it's structured. Bradley Lake Hydro, which is the largest hydro in the state right now, the state participated 50% on that project. Once the bonds are paid off, which is what your electrical rates pay off the bonds, when they are paid off, then the utilities will continue to send money to the state. And so that will be then paying off the state's portion of some of the state's capital.
So that would be like when the bonds are paid off in 30 years, then it would be almost like a low interest or no interest loan back to the state.
Yes, and it's 30 years from the start. And so it's actually in another 10 more years and those bonds will be paid off. And then the state will be receiving revenue from the electricity sales. And so the state will receive both the revenue going forward from that point. And also at this point is the lowest cost of energy for the most part along the rail belt. And so
Bradley Lake, right.
Yes, and so people are seeing lower cost electrical bills because of Bradley mm-hmm. Lake right now.
Let me turn, I want to thank you, Thomas, for your comment.
Said it was going to be really expensive.
Pardon me?
When they built Bradley Lake, they said the power was going to be really expensive, and it came in way under. What I understand is it's pumping into the grid at about 5 cents a kilowatt, and back then electricity gas was 4.5 cents a kilowatt, and they were saying, you know, Bradley Lake was going to be too expensive, and it is our savior.
I hear you. Okay, I want to thank you for your comment. I'm going to move on to another. We got a lot of calls. I'm going to keep moving on here. But I thank you, Thomas, for calling. I want to turn to you, Chris Rose, from Renewable Energy Project. If we're talking about this amount of money, what are we comparing it to? So in other words, we spend $5 billion or whatever amount we spend, it's still unclear, on this project. Are there other projects that we are forgoing, and should we be looking in terms of comparison? What is the menu of choices in front of us?
Well, that's a good question, because it's otherwise comparing apples to oranges. And one of the things to maybe put in perspective for the listeners is just how big this project is, because a 600-megawatt project or 600-megawatt Wautauna is not going to produce 600 megawatts over the course of the year. All of these projects, whether it's wind or solar or hydro, have what are called capacity factors, meaning that there's only a percentage of the 8,760 hours in the year that project can make its nameplate capacity. And with most hydro projects, it's somewhere in the range of 40 to 50%. So let's just say it's 50. That means we're only getting 300 megawatts out of Wautauna over the course of the year on average. Now, the average annual load of the rail belt is about 600 megawatts. So that's about half the power, roughly, maybe, if it's a 50% capacity factor. Our peak load is 800 megawatts. So I think that's important to start with, just to kind of lay the groundwork for what we're looking at in terms of how big this project is. The other thing about the cost of it is hydro is a much longer lived resource than some of these other plants. You know, a wind plant might last 25 years. A geothermal plant might last 40. There are hydro projects, including some here in Alaska, that are 100 years old. So the cost per kilowatt hour and the cost to society needs to be measured over a longer period of time with hydro. And I'm not sure how the state is trying to figure that out right now, whether it's over 50 years or 100 years or less. But in terms of what the upfront capital costs are, hydro, this particular project is pretty darn expensive when you compare it to, let's say, the capital cost of a geothermal project that actually has a 100% capacity factor. Most geothermal plants can actually produce almost 100% of the year. And so I think in order to understand what our choices are, especially if we're spending state money, you have to start looking at the actual amount of energy that you're going to be producing over the course of time. And it looks like this project's expensive, and it will be something that we need to look at, especially when you compare it to, let's say, efficiency. Because we all know, and it's proven, that the return on investment for efficiency measures is always cheaper than generating new electricity. So it raises the question of how much more efficiency should we be doing at the same time that we're doing more generation.
Well, is that something that you are doing or that somebody else is doing, is looking at the totality of the potential renewable projects to compare them?
Well, I think there's several independent power producers right now that are working in the rail belt, trying to get a project into the rail belt. Fire Island Wind with Cook Inlet Regional Incorporated, Mike Kraft with Delta Wind, Golden Valley is looking at a wind project in Riva Creek, and then Ormat, of course, in a very exciting development, thinks that there's a potential geothermal project over by Mount Spur. But all of those projects need what are called power purchase agreements from the utilities before they can move forward. And so those individual projects are all being negotiated currently with various utilities. And I think those utilities and the power producers themselves have a very good idea what those costs are. And so I wouldn't want to state what they are, but those numbers are out there.
Mm-hmm. I just want to disclose for the listeners that I'm a member of the board of directors for the Municipal Light and Power. So I do have some information and background on that. Don't think I have any conflict of interest in talking with you about that today, but I just want to make sure everyone knows that. I'd now like to turn to Francis, calling from Willow, who has a question about earthquakes. Francis?
Hi. Yes. With what's going on in Japan right now, it occurred to me, isn't there a real serious danger of a big catastrophe building dams in earthquake country?
Let me turn to Toby, because he brought that issue up in terms of when you talk about putting all our eggs in one basket. What are your thoughts about the hazards, and why is that a hazard?
Yeah, and that's a great question. I've had the same thoughts the past few days, and it does come back again to putting all of your energy eggs into one basket. And I think that anybody who's invested in the stock market knows that diversity is a mantra there. And so anytime, I think energy is a very similar analogy. And, we're talking about possibly $5 billion, the state possibly, subsidizing up to half of that. And I just want to comment on the other caller's comment that I could be wrong, but I don't think that that would really benefit rural. I think it's more of a rail belt beneficiary. But I think that it's a huge concern. We are looking at alternatives. We believe that we could reach the 50% goal with a broad portfolio, a diverse one of renewable projects. And it just seems that the state has a responsibility to also look at that possibility and not be making sure that they are diversified for a much more sustainable future.
So let me turn to Brian Carey again on that from the Energy Authority. Can you address the earthquake question and also the range of other options that we could be looking at?
Okay. First, in regards to earthquake, earthquake motions are well understood, and no modern dam has failed because of an earthquake. Currently, they're building large dams, much larger than this, in all over the world. If you go down to California, there are very large dams located in close proximity to faults, and so they certainly believe that they could be designed to handle extreme earthquakes. In regards to looking at the other options, a couple of years ago, the Alaska Energy Authority, in consultation with the utilities, did the Integrated Resource Plan. And the Integrated Resource Plan was a comparison of, one is what the future needs or demands of energy along the rail belt were, and also how they were going to get supplied. And so they looked at the various wind, nuclear, coal, gas, hydro, and what would be the least cost options for the rail belt moving forward. And so it looked at various high growth, low growth scenarios.
I see. I guess I would turn to Toby. Have you looked at that plan? What are your thoughts on that?
I haven't. It's true that none of the scenarios, and there were multiple scenarios presented in there, none of them posed a scenario where 50% could be achieved. However, several came quite close, closer than I might have thought, 45, even 46%. And so what that leads us to believe, and there were some assumptions made in there Energy efficiency, which has been mandated by the state to be increased, I don't believe that was really factored. And there's some other factors as well, which would indicate that we could reach the 50% goal without a mega hydro project such as Susitna.
I see. Well, let me just to complete, since our caller was is calling from Willow, is there anybody living downstream from the dam, or is it just pure wilderness out there in terms of when we talk about an earthquake hazard? I'm just, and I know you don't think it would ever fall down, but just in terms of what's out there, I'm just not really that familiar whether there's, how far it is from Talkeetna or any other population center.
Well, Talkeetna is 90 miles downriver. There are people that live along the Susitna River downriver from it. Dams do not fail catastrophically. If there's any type of release of water, one, it's going to take time to get down there. And as part of the licensing process, there's detailed studies that must occur in terms of, one is what the likelihood of it ever occurring, but what areas could get inundated, how long it would take, and those other studies.
Yeah. Okay. Francis, we have many, many calls. Does that answer your question adequately?
Well, not really, because I don't think, I think there's far more importance should be paid to it. I think this is the whole problem with so many things. We think, oh, it'll be all right. We can design for this. But then the ultimate catastrophe comes, and we haven't designed for it. And this seems to happen over and over again. And I really don't see that that's an answer, but anyway, thank you.
All right. Bye-bye. Well, thanks for your comment. And I think Toby had one more thing to add.
I just want to say, I have a feeling no one predicted what's happening in Japan now. Mm-hmm. And so I just want to back up the caller.
Right. Well, it's a great topic. And we've got a number of other callers that we're going to get to shortly. I just want to let everybody know that you're listening to Hometown Alaska on KSKA. My name is Charles Wolforth from Alaska Energy Authority. And my guest is Brian Carey, who's a project manager from the Alaska Center for the Environment. Their executive director, Toby Smith, is in the studio. And on the line from New York City is Chris Rose from the Renewable Energy Alaska Project. And I should note that Chris's organization is a nonprofit contributor to KSKA. I mentioned my own potential conflict of interest, but I have to make sure to disclose that too. We've got a couple of more calls on earthquakes, but Ruth in Talkeetna has been waiting quite a while, so I wanted to get her on the air. Ruth, what was your comment?
Well, my comment, I'm from Talkeetna, and we are worried about an earthquake. I will put that, because I think downtown Talkeetna would be completely flooded, and dams do fail catastrophically. You can Google it and see. But my question is really about cost, because I do not think that AEA is presenting the cost correctly. And because if the state subsidizes it, it does mean it will be cheaper to the utility and thus to the ratepayer. But that means the state is subsidizing it with our money that could be used elsewhere. So I have heard that the cost per kilowatt hour is really about 20 cents. So I want someone to convince me that is not correct. And that and I don't mean by saying, oh, no, it's 17 cents. I would like to see a true cost per kilowatt hour so that we can actually see compare costs, because if the state subsidized the wind at Fire Island, that would be a lot cheaper to the utilities and to the ratepayers. So I think that no matter how it is paid for, ultimately the state is going to, if it's a state project, the state is going to be paying that 20 cents per kilowatt hour.
Right. Okay, well, that's an excellent that's an excellent point. I think that it's also true that the state has contributed funds to Fire Island for a power line to get to the island. But I guess the way I'd bring that to you, Brian Carey, is that we don't know yet the cost, so we can't really estimate the cost per kilowatt hour. There's a pretty good span. When will we know, assuming that the appropriations are made to continue studying the project, when would that question that Ruth is asking be answered, that, you know, what is the cost per kilowatt hour, you know, for the totality of it or for the state-funded portion, non-state-funded portion?
Well, in the shorter term, we're going to have a lot better numbers just during the next year. But the final cost type numbers, a lot of that really depends on what the interest rate is that you end up financing it. And so what the interest rates are going to be for bonds 5 years from now is a big unknown. The difference between 4% or 6% is a huge difference in terms of what the cost of power would be.
Right. Well, let me ask you a question, Chris Rose, in terms of comparing this project, these other projects that you've discussed that are being done by power, independent power producers, they have to come up with a cost because they have to enter into a power purchase agreement with a utility, and that's how they finance. Is this project, in a sense, being, you know, has to be judged in a different way because the state is doing it, and it's not really up to the utilities, right? I mean, if the project is built, they'll take the power. Or what's your? Can you give some insight on that?
Well,
the comparability.
My understanding is all the railroad utilities would like to buy power from this project, so I think they're all committing to that. But of course, that's under the condition that the state pay down a large portion of it, and the state has not been offering to pay down that large of a percentage on these other projects. So I think, again, comparing apples to apples is important to determine what the cost of a project is. Now, but overall, I think we also have to look at what we've got here in the rail belt, which is a huge dependency on natural gas, particularly in the Cook Inlet region here. And we all know that the availability of gas is dwindling until and unless we get more production, and that might be something that we'd be wishing for a while, since the anchor tenants in Cook Inlet are going away, including the LNG plant, and the price of gas has been going up, and again, that's the advantage of renewable energy, whether it be hydro, wind, geothermal, any of these don't have a fuel cost. And so I think ultimately we need to be looking at all these projects. I don't think there is a silver bullet. That's one of the main points that we want to get across, is that even if we do this hydro project, it's not going to happen for 15 years, and it's not really a silver bullet. It's not going to cover all our needs. These other things have to happen, and we would hope to see that the state would support these other projects as well.
All right. Well, that is Chris Rose from the Renewable Energy Alaska Project. My other guests today are Toby Smith from the Alaska Center for the Environment and Brian Carey from the Alaska Energy Authority. I've got a number of callers. And Ruth, thank you for calling. We're going to go to a break now. Other callers, please hold on the line. We'll, I'm sure, get to everyone if you hold out. And I would like to let everyone know that if you want to get involved in the discussion, the number here, I'll give that number right after the break, and so you can have your pencil ready. So we're going to go to a break. You're listening to Hometown Alaska on KSKA.
If you missed part of today's program, or if you'd like to listen again to Hometown Alaska on KSKA, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. A copy of Hometown Alaska will be available this afternoon on our website at kska.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Back on Hometown Alaska, we're talking about the Susitna Power Project. I want to draw your attention to some resources that we have on the website at kska.org if you want to learn more about it. I've put some news stories up there, particularly the one that came out in November 4th of 2010, when the Energy Authority completed a study that was comparing potential hydro projects and essentially chose the Susitna Lewontana project rather than the Chacachamna project on the far side of Cook Inlet. And then at that time, Governor Parnell threw his support behind the project, and now It is going forward in the legislature for appropriations to get that project, that concept going forward. And you'll find some other resources there, including the Alaska Energy Authority's own page, where they've compiled a number of the reports and studies that have been done on this project, so that if you want to learn more, you'll find everything you want there. So we're continuing to talk about the Susitna project here on Hometown Alaska, and your calls are very welcome. It's a hot topic, and I know a lot of opinions and questions to address. The number here is 550-8433, and if you're calling from outside the Anchorage area, you can do it toll-free at 888-353-5752, and email is hometownalaska@ksk.org. Make sure you use that address, hometownalaska@ksk.org, and that'll come to me here in the studio. I would like to read an email right now before we get to a couple of callers. This is a caller, and I think this is a good question probably for Toby and for Brian. He was a recreational rafter during the early study period on the river. He points out that the Susitna River has large amounts of sediment in its water course, and he's concerned a dam would capture volumes of the sediment. His question is, how would you handle the sediment? Would it be excavated, removed, transported from the dam site? And would that affect water quality, or could it maybe even be beneficial to fish if we were removing sediment from the river? Brian Carey, what's the sediment issue there with the dam?
Well, certainly the reservoir would catch a lot of the sediment coming down from the glaciers. And however, it would just sit there because the amount of time it would take for the reservoir to affect the dam in terms of the amount of sediment in it, it's realistically hundreds of years. And so the sediment, the silt will build up behind the dam, and at some point, hundreds of years from now, they'll have to do something. Now, for the effects, the water below the dam will have had more of the heavy silt dropped out. And so the water below the dam will actually have less turbidity than it has right now until you get to the Chulitna River. Because at the Chulitna River, you have quite a lot of silt come in from the Alaska Range. And so at least in the section from Wetonera to Talkeetna, the water would become slightly more clear. That's during the summertime. During the wintertime, you'd have a little bit more turbidity than you currently have, but it'd still be pretty clear water.
Well, turning to Toby Smith for the environmental perspective, is there a potential enhancement here in any way if you have less silt in the water, or are you concerned more about the existing fish populations? How do you look at the whole fish issue?
Yeah, I mean, siltation is a concern. On the engineering side, I would defer to Brian on that, but there are concerns with fish in terms of there's been discussion about water being warmer because it's held in a reservoir, and that might have possibly detrimental effects for fish that hatch in the spring and there's not enough food at that early point in the year, so there's some concerns there, as well as I mentioned earlier, possibility of them not being able to access some of the clear water tributaries that they need for spawning, because the fish aren't necessarily spawning in the Susitna because of silt and other reasons, but they do need to access the Susitna to get where they're going.
I understand. Now I'd like to turn to Steve, who had a comment calling from Anchorage. Steve?
Yeah, good afternoon. My question is, with the area that we're talking about, there's a lot of schist and shale in that area, and if you put a dam creating a reservoir, even if that dam is on bedrock, what about the sides? Isn't water going to seep through, create cracks, going through a freeze and dry cycle, and eventually the river will just go around the entire dam?
Interesting question. It's news to me. Brian Carey from the Energy Authority, have you looked at the geology of the area and how the reservoir would hold up?
Well, extensive drilling was done back in the 1980s to look at the rock types and determine if there's any passages around. And the rock type is a very solid rock. I forgot exactly which kind it is, but it's very solid. And it's not expected to be any problems about water going around. They've drilled large quantities of holes, and we would be needing to drill more holes to determine if there's any fault lines or passable routes for water around it.
All right. Does that answer your question, Steve?
Yeah, I do have another quick question. I'll take it off the air.
All right. Because we've got many callers, but go ahead.
What would be the effects of an 80-square-mile lake in the middle of the Alaska Range?
You mean in terms of geology or earthquakes or something?
No, I'm talking about just weather. How would that affect the weather? As in the Gunnison Lake in Colorado changed the weather patterns in that area.
Interesting.
San Juan Mountains.
Have they looked at that? As 260 million, they must have looked at a lot. Did they look at that issue? I've never heard that one before.
As to changing it, well, first off, 80 square miles is much on the large side. If you look at the size of what the reservoir was, it was going to be 20,000 acres. And so that converts over, I believe, to 31 square miles.
Mm-hmm.
And then in regards to weather patterns, I'm not sure if they looked at that, if that reservoir would have a change in the weather patterns for the area.
Okay. We're going to just keep going through the callers because we have a lot of them, and now I'd like to turn to Rich, who's calling from Anchorage. Rich?
Yes, thanks for taking my call. Good afternoon. My name's Rich. I'm from I'm with a group called Alaska Ratepayers, and we've been studying the possibility of long-range electric energy policy for about 3 years now as an independent group, and we're looking for the longest term answer with affordable energy and working within good environmental principles. And we think that this project at Wautauna is certainly the best answer and one of the best opportunities in America, I guess, if you will, for a new project to be built. We think that the ratepayers are going to be benefiting for a long time, and in effect, we look at it as a kind of a permanent fund dividend forever once we get the rates levelized. And to get the rates at affordable levels initially, we applaud the concept of the state kicking in 50% of the cost, investing it, and then being paid back over the long term after the bonds for the other half are paid back. And so we think that this is an excellent way for ratepayers to benefit across the rail belt and actually for other areas of the state to be benefited by extending lines with lower cost energy available to them. My question is, what is the benefit of a low cost energy to the economic opportunities in the region?
In other words, in the earlier project, when it was projected that there would be much more energy than would be needed, there was the idea that it would spawn the creation of new industries because there would be a lot of low cost energy, and so energy intensive industries might come in. And actually, if you go all the way back to the 50s and 60s, that was the idea behind the Yukon River Rampart Dam, is that even though it would create way more energy than you needed, you'd spawn new energy, new industries. Chris Rose, is that in the offing with this project? Is it big enough that it would bring in new industry that needed energy?
Well, as I mentioned before, you know, it's really not that much power if you look at the capacity factor. 600 megawatts times 50%, only adding 300 megawatts, that just helps us get off natural gas. I don't think it's the kind of project like we were looking at in the 1980s where you would be inviting new industry in. And I think that, you know, there's advantages to not only having low price power, but having certain price power. And that, again, is the advantage of any renewable energy, is that you have certainty over the long term, that you don't have to buy fuel, and therefore you have a really good idea of what your electricity is going to cost. So even if it's higher than we have today, it's still attractive to businesses because it's guaranteed over the long term. And if you look at the cost of energy, cost of electricity, that is, in different places around the world, it varies all over the map. And it doesn't necessarily correlate that you have less activity with higher energy prices, because if that higher energy price actually is also very flat, it's still attractive. And I guess the other thing that, you know, is talked about more and more all the time is that there's actually a disincentive, or I should put it this way, there's really an incentive to be efficient if you have a higher price. And so in some ways, people would say, well, if the price is just a little bit higher, it actually will incentivize people to use more efficient devices and so on. But the amount of power that we're looking at from Wautauna is not that tremendous. It's not a silver bullet. It would certainly help give us a huge amount of renewable power But relative to the total load, it's nothing like the 80s project.
All right. Thank you. That was Chris Rose. And now I'd like to, I think Toby Smith wants to add something to that.
Just one comment to that, and maybe it's changed, but my understanding is that this dam would actually be what they're calling expandable, where there could be additional stages built on. And for those who are concerned about the possibility of bringing in new industries, possibly extractive industries, that could be a potential future scenario that listeners should be aware of.
So you're taking the perspective, you don't want new industry.
I'm only just posing that question, making sure that listeners understand that could be a future scenario.
I see. So it's expandable. I hadn't heard that before. Steve in Wasilla, you had a comment.
Yeah. Hi, Charles. I'm a civil engineer, and I also own 66 acres of land at Trapper Creek on the Big Sioux, right basically across from Talkeetna. So I'm definitely concerned about environmental impacts of this project. But on the other hand, the way I look at it, Cook Inlet is running out of gas. The North Slope gas pipeline looks like it's not going to happen anytime in the foreseeable future. If we are going to harness wind energy, we need to be able to balance that energy so we have a source when the wind is not blowing. And I believe that the Wautauna project would have the capability of doing that to a certain extent. And the other thing that concerns me is that we just got over having a huge fight in the valley here a few years ago about a coal-fired power plant. And I really don't want to see a coal-fired power plant out my front window. So although I'm not completely 100% on board with Susitna, I think that we have to look at it very seriously. And we have to study it, but at some point we're going to have to stop studying and we're going to have to take some action, or we're not going to have power to keep the lights on. And recently in Civil Engineering magazine, there was a very extensive story about Hoover Dam, and there are some negatives attached to Hoover Dam, but as far as the electric portion, it's completely paid for itself. So I'll hang up and listen on the air, okay? Thank you.
Good comment.
Charles.
Go ahead, Chris.
Chris, if I could just make a comment, I think that Steve made a really excellent comment in that he's trying to make us understand that there are choices here, and we've been really relying on gas. That gas is going away. Utilities like to use baseload power. It's very effective when you can control when you're using the electricity. And one of our only other baseload choices is coal. And as he mentioned, there are a lot of people who would rather not have coal. So if we want to keep charging our cell phones and we want to keep using all these devices, we really have to start making choices about where the energy is going to come from in the future.
But I would throw this out to all of our guests. There's a long lead time on this project, on the order of, 14, 15 years. And our gas is really running out now. In fact, we've come close in the last year or two to not having enough gas to run our utilities. So how do we bridge, assuming we were to build this project, and either Chris or Brian could answer this, or Toby, if you have a comment, how do we bridge from here to there? Brian?
A couple things. We're looking at a schedule of once we start the FERC process, which we have not. We're looking at first power in about 11 years or so is the best guess at this time. However, for the bridging in the short term, you can run Bradley Lake more during the wintertime. Power can always come down from Fairbanks if need be over the intertie. And that could be just during the next year or two as they work on the gas storage option. And so within a couple of years, gas is going to have to come into the Cook Inlet region. Now, that's going to be either from a pipeline, or if you're looking at only 2 or 3 years, it's more likely you may have to bring some in by ship and put it to the gas storage.
Okay. Now I'd like to turn to an email. David in Palmer has this comment. Something that seems to be missing from our energy discussions is the fact that our transmission lines are 40 years old. Whatever decisions we make about our energy will involve distributing power from a variety of sources. We need a new scalable smart grid. Shouldn't we commit first to funding a modern grid that can handle a variety of sources, wind, solar, tidal, hydro, natural gas, or whatever? Toby's nodding. Would you have a reaction to that?
Oh, I do, and that's a great comment. And this kind of comes back to a comment I wanted to make after Ruth's call in terms of costs. And our understanding is that in order for Susitna to be viable, we would need an infrastructure upgrade, and that could cost on the order of an additional $1 billion on top of the actual dam construction costs. So that needs to be factored in. But I agree with the caller, and that would have to happen in order for this to be viable. Yeah.
Have those numbers been worked, Brian, from the Energy Authority? Have you worked through the numbers in terms of how do you get the power to Anchorage, and is that part of the figure you're talking about?
Well, one is the cost estimates for the dam is to bring the energy to the existing intertie. We had to figure out some place that things get cut off at. As part of the integrated resource plan, they looked at the intertie. Even without Susitna to occur, they're looking at upgrades for the intertie to better ensure reliability of the electrical system of more than half a billion dollars, and that's without Susitna. So why there would be upgrades in regards to Susitna occur of several hundred million more, there is still very substantial money that's going to have to be spent both on interties and on generation plants within South Central and Interior over the coming years.
Yeah, one of the things that I've learned in looking at the whole energy picture for South Central is that there don't seem to be any cheap alternatives. We've really built Anchorage on cheap gas power for decades. That gas is going away, and there's nothing out there that is going to in any way equate to what we've used in the past. Would you agree with that, Chris? I mean, it seems like part of our challenge as a community is that we're accustomed to some of the lowest energy prices anywhere in the country. And if we make choices going into the future, that's not one of our options, but it's a little bit hard to get used to.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. We've had artificially low energy prices here relative to many places in the country. And we have an expectation mentality in the state, too. I mean, we all wait for our checks in October. So it's a lot different expectation, I think, here than in a lot of places. Many places around the country, in fact, many places in our state, are paying 40, 50, 60, 70 cents a kilowatt hour. There are places in the bush that are paying over a dollar a kilowatt hour. So when you start realizing that we're asking our own citizens at this moment to pay 50, 60, 70 cents a kilowatt hour, the 20 cents, even without a state subsidy, doesn't look so bad, especially if it lasts for 100 years. But we know that the cheapest unit of energy is the one you don't have to produce. That's efficiency. And we know that it always costs less to put in efficiency measures than it does to cost to build new generation. So we need to do that, and that's one of the biggest things we can use to bridge while we do these other generation plants, like the wind. The three wind projects that are being considered right now would take about 5% of the gas burn away. So, you know, that's not insignificant.
But when you talk about... I'm sorry. I was just going to say that the state has actually put quite a bit of money into energy efficiency and into alternatives, right? I mean, there is the $300 million for HFC to increase home energy efficiency and a $250 million renewable energy fund. Are those not adequate in your view?
Well, this is the beginning. Cole Climate Housing Research Center estimates that we're going to need well over $2 billion to weatherize all the homes in the state. So that $360 million is a start. And then when you compare, you know, the $150 million, and maybe we'll get $250 million, we certainly hope so, Renewable Energy Fund, that's about one-tenth of the proposed state contribution to this one project. So clearly... You know, we need more energy infrastructure. In my view, it's just as important as the roads, and we all take for granted the state pay for the roads. Well, we all need electricity, and so I think it is a proper place for the state to get involved. But again, we're hoping that there might be some equality in how the state treats all these projects. The other thing I just wanted to mention, too, in terms of timing and bridging and also meeting that 50% goal is it is very likely that we're going to see commercial tidal power in the next 10 years. There's already a commercial project in Ireland, and that technology is going to keep coming along. And, of course, we've got one of the best resources in the world in Cook Inlet. So that's certainly something that we could be relying on 10, 12 years down the road, about the same time Wetana would come on.
Yeah, I think we have a question about that, actually. Caroline, do you want to get your question in about tidal power?
Well, actually, I was thrilled to hear the statement because it was the one renewable that was not mentioned earlier. Tidal power was something that the Rothschild, the French banker, came over here wanting the state to get involved with a project he wanted to do either in Cook Inlet or I think it was in the Fundy Bay. And he wanted to build a causeway that would have the tidal generating fans, I think they were looking at them, but this is more than 30 years ago, and the state wanted to study it, and he said enough study already, and he said, he said in this room, I got the comments from someone that was there, he said, there are three people in the world that know what I'm talking about, and I'm one of them, so I'll see you around. Now, I don't know what success he had in the Fundy Bay, but it's being used on the East Coast, and tides keep going, whether or not there is a busted bridge or whether or not there is a problem with radiation or whatever. So I think that is one place, because looking at what can happen in 5 to 10 years' time, and again, as you mentioned before, the opportunity costs from spending this money on that project, which is already like a sponge, soaked up a ton of money here in Alaska, to just say, let's wait and pull in other things. Because Alaska, as you mentioned, I mean, the whole coast has tides. And I've been up here over 40 years, and I was thrilled to see them put wind generators in Kotzebue, because I remember being nearly blown off the street when I was up there in the late 70s. So
thanks for the comment.
A great show.
Okay, thank you. We need to go to one more caller so we can make sure we get everybody on the air. And my next caller is Mark, who's calling from Palmer. What's your comment, Mark?
Well, while I've been on hold, thanks for taking my call, but while I've been on hold, you kind of touched on it, but I wanted to address the economic issue of what's cheaper, because that's what made me call when you said what's cheaper, and Chris has hit the nail on the head. There's a lot cheaper ways to save energy than necessarily build big generation facilities, not necessarily against hydro, but it's far cheaper to incentivize energy efficiency and conservation, and I hope at some point encourage a lot of distributed renewable generation, hundreds of small projects. So I think that we need to think about that from a fiscal perspective, that it's far cheaper to do that, and it's faster, and when we talk about getting generation quickly. Thanks.
All right, thank you. And you know, we're out of time, but we can take a very quick closing comment, maybe from you, Brian, because you haven't had a chance to talk for a minute. Do you have a 30-second sum up for us?
Well, certainly, South Central areas and Interior is looking at energy problems in the coming years, and Susitna would be one that would help assist take care of those problems. It will not take care of everything. We will still have a need for gas to have here, mm-hmm. and we have not started the timeline yet, so we are still very much preliminary conceptual design work.
Thank you very much. Well, I want to thank all my guests. It's been a really quick hour. Brian Carey was here from the Alaska Energy Authority, Toby Smith from the Alaska Center for the Environment, and Chris Rose on the phone from the Renewable Energy Alaska Project in New York. My name is Charles Wolforth. I've been your host on Hometown Alaska. Our engineer is Kristen Spack. Pat Yak directs public media here at KSKA. And we thank you for being with us. That's it for today. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music for Hometown Alaska is Lead Dog, composed and performed by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Views expressed on Hometown Alaska are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available on our website at kska.org, and CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.